Without introduction, we will call forward Mr. Clyde Snowblin to deliver his topic to us tonight, The Highway.
Good evening, everyone. Well, Mark was busy giving me a somewhat overrated introduction. I was standing there completely dizzy, feeling like I was going to fall flat on my face. And it turns out that I had my computer glasses on. It had just got a new prescription. And so it was all fuzzy out there. I think it would be better here, but let's go with what I've got. Anyway, we added a subtitle tonight to The Highway, and that is Bible Prophecy 101. Now, Bible Prophecy 101 is about Israel. This presentation is about Israel. And our subtitle of Prophecy 101 is a standard topic, I know. And tonight we're going to start with giving a brief recounting of basic promises regarding Israel and Abraham and Jacob. That's really the foundation, of course, of all Bible prophecy, stemming from these verses that we're going to have a look at in the early chapters of Genesis. Then we want to have a look at some of the foundations of the Jewish nation. What makes them what they are, and a bit of their history. Then we want to start looking at some contemporary thoughts on anti-Semitism to try and get a bit of a handle, if you like, on why all of this crazy anti-Semitism has kind of popped up, I think fairly recently, last two or three years. So some contemporary thoughts on that. Then we'll have a current reality check on what's going on in the world and in the land, and some overlooked prophecies. You might imagine that the reading from Zephaniah is one of those overlooked prophecies. I've been looking at this Bible for pretty much all my life, and I'm afraid I couldn't even find Zephaniah. I had to tell Mark, but he already knew. Between Habakkuk and Haggai. You can find it. But it's a prophecy that I don't really have much knowledge of. And if you said to me, well, what does Zephaniah have to say? I'd say, I don't know. Well, let's have a look tonight at that. Some overlooked prophecies and a look at the glorious future, of course, of Israel and of the land. I want to start here with the promises to Abraham, looking at a map. And I've called this the roadmap to eternity, because the promises made to Abraham are promises regarding eternity. And we're very specific here that Abraham began actually in the record, Genesis chapter 12 and 1, up in Haran, which is up here in Syria, modern day Syria. It has been called Assyria, but for our purposes tonight and purposes of history, Syria. He starts in Syria. He comes down south under the direction of God through this land and down into Egypt. Interesting that his beginning in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, takes him to Egypt directly by the time we get to verse 10 of Genesis chapter 12. That is the roadmap of the promises of Abraham. And you can see here that we picked up some places along the way. And these places that we've illustrated here are places on the map today. Amazingly, 4,000 years later, you can find these places, inhabited villages or monuments or whatever. They're all there. Shechem and Bethel, chapter 12, verse 6. Negev, the south, down into Egypt, chapter 12, verse 10. Bethel, the Oaks of Mamre, this is a spot where Abraham kind of settled for a while. Hebron, probably the main place of Abraham's sojournings, he builds an altar there. Chapter 14, verse 18, he's actually in the city of Jerusalem where he meets Melchizedek, who is referred to as the priest of the Most High God. Back to the Negev, down to Kadesh and Shur Gerar, which is actually the land of the Philistines just north of Egypt. Back to the Negev and making a covenant with the Philistines and living in Beersheba, which was just east of Philistine territory, comes back to the land of Moriah, Beersheba, and buries his wife in Hebron. So this pretty much covers the life of Abraham. All these places existing today on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean Sea in the land of Israel. Here's the roadmap of Abraham's travels from Syria in the north to Egypt in the south, and then back to the center of the land. So let's have a look at these promises a bit closer. Maybe I'm going to need these glasses after all. The Lord said to Abraham, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, Haran, heading south, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And these words are familiar to probably all of us in this room from Sunday school in the very early days we began reading the Bible. I will bless you and those who bless you and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. These are specific words in these specific promises. Promises, again, that are alive today in the land in relation to the offspring of Abraham. He gets down to the middle of the land where Lot separates from him, and he says, lift up your eyes and look to the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. And a pretty good view of most of the center of what we know as the land of Israel today. All the land you see I will give you and your offspring forever. And I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can count the dust of the earth, your offspring will also be counted. Then, to your offspring, chapter 15, I will give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, this is a phrase that's been popularized today by Israel's enemies. From the river Euphrates to the sea. From the river to the sea? Something like that. But taken from this ancient prophecy. This land is the land of Abraham, the land of Israel. Promises in relation to the entire world. Behold, my covenant is with you and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. For I have made you the father of a multitude of nations, and I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you. And I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. So restating the promise to Abraham is the promise to the world of actual descendants, nations, kings, coming out of him. And then, after obedience to God and being prepared to sacrifice his son, put a halt to by God's intervention, he says to Abraham, because you have done this and you have withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. So extending this promise to Abraham to include a savior of the world, and we could spend time on that, but we just want to move on in relation to the promises. We have to then carry on with the promises to Jacob. Now, Jacob is Abraham's grandson. His journeys, interestingly, took him pretty much through the same country. He left home, where he was living down in the middle of the land with his father and his brother and so on. He had to leave home, so he heads north. He goes back up to Haran, where his father came from and where his mother came from, to find a wife, to seek his fortune. And God said to him in a vision as he heads north, and behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land that you will, on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring, and your offspring will be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your offspring will all families of the earth be blessed. And he said to Jacob as he's heading north to go up to Syria, I am with you and I will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, which in fact is what happened. And finally, we know that the family of Jacob was forced to go down into Egypt during a time of 7 years of famine. And Jacob didn't do that without a bit of apprehension. And so the Lord appeared to Jacob and said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you a great nation. And I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again. Now, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's descendants would go down into Egypt as God had promised. And over 400 years later, they came up from Egypt as a nation of maybe a million people, up or down. And that path of Abraham's nation from Egypt went to Mount Sinai. Abraham and Jacob's nation, Israel, ended up in the desert at Mount Sinai with an eternal message that was given not only to Israel, but also to the civilized world. And I think sometimes we underestimate the value of this encounter of Israel at Sinai. And here's a summary of the laws that are often presented as the Ten Commandments. Number one, there's only one God. Number two, the rest of all man's inventions and imaginations to create other gods, they have no power and have no power to save or to create, so have nothing to do with them. Thirdly, he, that is the God of Israel, deserves the utmost reverence and respect from civilized societies. Number four, you need to take time out of your busy, self-serving life to worship and honor the God of Israel. And five, the family is the basic foundation of life and living. Now, I don't think it's a big stretch to be able to say these type of laws are fundamental to civilization. There's five more, of course, which have to do with how we relate to one another. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And you shall not covet anything that is your neighbor's. So quite apart from the worship of God, there are five commandments that need to be applied to daily living in any civilized world, quite apart from your specific religion. These are commandments that work worldwide throughout history. And so Israel becomes a light-bearing nation, not just in the land of promise, but also, as Isaiah says in chapter 60, verse 1 to 3, arise and shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples, but the Lord will arise upon you, and his glory will be seen upon you, and nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. So it was understood from the very beginning that these laws that the people of Israel got from Mount Sinai, directly as a revelation to the nation, were going to become foundational to civilization on the earth. That is, for civilizations that wanted to have order and peace and calm. Well, that's wonderful, but what happened to this light-bearing nation? That's an interesting question. Instead of being the blessing that they should have become, they became a taunt and a byword. Why all the anti-Semitism in the world today, in the history of the world? Why do nations hate Israel today and have always hated Israel? Well, because Israel abandoned their God, abandoned the covenants, and went their own way. And because God had allowed them to become, as we see here in Deuteronomy 28, a terror, a proverb, and a byword among all the nations and people wherever God led them. In a strange kind of way, that kind of preserved the uniqueness of God's people because of pressure, because of persecution that they endured. 2 Chronicles 7:19, words are come up again. Then I will pluck you up from my land that I have given you and this house that I have consecrated for my name. I will cast you out of my sight and I will make you a proverb and a byword among all peoples. Because they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt and laid hold of other gods and worshiped them and served them in contravention of the simple commandments that God gave them on Mount Sinai. I will make them a horror to all the kingdoms of the earth, to be a reproach, a byword, a taunt, a curse in all the places where I will drive them. So they abandoned the Lord. God allowed them to become a taunt and a reproach. And even to the point of their enemies wanting to take their land, or their enemies saying, well, we'll just take our land and Israel's land, and showing their hatred. Even just imagine Israel's enemies claiming that the covenant land to Abraham and the promises made to Abraham, that they would take it as their own. So I want to change gears for a few moments, draw attention to a current assessment of this situation. And I picked up a book recently called Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West, because this is very much a topic of concern worldwide right now, as Israel has been brought back into focus in the last couple of years, and some extreme pressures have been brought upon Israel. Now, Josh Hammer, I won't give you any of the credits or the bio on Josh Hammer, because there are many, and we don't want to take a lot of time doing that. And if you say, well, what about this guy? You know, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, I have the book here, and I'll loan it to you. And I read it, so I'm sure you could. The Jewish people and the Jewish state of Israel are the West's frontline strongholds in the battle against Islamic terrorism and destructive wokeism. So as goes Israel, so goes Western civilization. With Israel and civilization, columnist, prominent commentator, and legal scholar Josh Hammer launches an audacious manifesto declaring that the fate of Western civilization hinges on the enduring strength of the Jewish people and of the state of Israel. He argues for a realist U.S. foreign policy and tight-knit U.S.-Israel relationship, while voices advocating against the Jewish people and the Jewish state are ascendant. Hammer combats this ancient scourge by sounding a defiant call to enthusiastically embrace the centrality of Judaism to Western civilization itself. So he presents a current evaluation of the nation of Israel and the surrounding nations and how this is working out. Here's some comments from people who know him. Ben Shapiro, for example, a brilliant thinker, an extraordinary lucid writer, shows just why battles far away in the Middle East go straight to the heart of the battles at the root of Western civilization. A Christian who disregards the connections to the land and the people of Israel saws off the branch of the tree on which he sits. A Christian who disregards the connections to the land and the people of Israel saws off the branch of the tree on which he sits. Remarkable statement, actually, because there's more and more people today, Christians, as we would call them, Bible believers, who are a little edgy about Israel. And in that initial promise, he who curses Israel will be cursed, he who blesses Israel will be blessed, comes burning down to our day. Once we want to separate ourselves from Israel, we cut off the branch of the tree on which we're sitting. Governor Ron DeSantis, in depth and thought-provoking, he says of this book, encapsulates the importance of Israel's fight for existence as part of a broader battle to preserve the Judeo-Christian values at the heart of America's founding. So he takes on this astounding enigma of anti-Semitism that rears its ugly head every once in a while throughout history, and certainly has done that over the last few years. He has a strong message for Christians facing the dilemmas of the world today. Israel is eternally connected with the so-called Western nations, the nations that have founded their constitutions and laws primarily on the Bible, Old and New Testament. These Western nations are linked through common beliefs to an eternal set of laws that are foundational to all civilization. That goes right back to Moses on Mount Sinai. Think about it. If you removed thought processes inherent in the Bible from Western governance, what kind of world would remain? If you remove thought processes inherent in the Bible from Western governance, what kind of world would remain? And why is this happening? Why is this shift happening? Because there is very little Bible reading in the Western nations these days. So he goes on to say, no other people in the history of the world has ever made a claim to a national revelation. National revelation at Mount Sinai, a million people. The law is being transmitted to Moses directly from heaven. There are many individual prophets throughout history, some true and some false, who have claimed personal revelation from the Creator. But only the Jews have ever encountered divine revelation at a national level. The Jews codified these laws and teachings from the lawgiver of all lawgivers, and they studied and retained them in precise manner, in a direct and unbroken chain from generation to generation, despite persecution, diaspora, and countless other tragedies. Jews as far apart as Yemen, Poland, Morocco, Lithuania, and France retained and practiced the exact same text, an exact same set of laws, differing only in customs and other subsidiary cultural traditions. The divine revelation at Sinai was not and is not merely about the Jews. The divine revelation that took place at Mount Sinai was an earth-shattering event to all peoples. But why does Israel, and why has Israel been vilified throughout history? We've already alluded to that with these verses that we've looked at. Well, it's partly because of the divine revelation. Why do people hate Israel? The only nation that has a divine revelation. Islam, Buddhism, the main religions of India, Marxism, communism, have a problem with the divine revelation. The divine revelation is fading in the West under the forces of wokeism, liberalism, and lawlessness, and because people in the Western nations are no longer people of the book. Israel is a lonely place, and Western civilization is a fading reality. If Israel dies, so does Western civilization. Now, Judaism is not a universalist faith like Christianity. Rather, Judaism is at its core a particularist nationhood and peoplehood with an abiding and eternal attachment to a very specific plot of ground, promised to that nation and Israel long ago by God himself, and which overwhelming archaeological evidence corroborates has been continuously inhabited by that same nation going back millennia. Other people say it's their land, but that's not true. As such, the people of Israel's attachment to the land of Israel is not merely non-negotiable. It is a core tenet of Judaism itself to seek to sever the connection between the nation of Israel and the people of Israel and the land of Israel is, by definition, anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish. The world has to ignore archaeology and history and reality to claim that Israel has no right to the land. It's kind of like standing in defiance of the Creator, of the God of Israel, and the Father of the Messiah. There's no other minority people. Not the Kurds, not the Yazidis, nor the Zoroastrians, nor anyone else in between, whose right to exist as a concrete nation and to defend itself as a concrete people have been as incessantly challenged as they have been for the Jews. There's no other modern nation state, not Japan, Paraguay, Ghana, or anyone in between, whose right to exist and to defend itself are as continually challenged and doubted as they are for the world's lone Jewish state. Anti-Semitism is a bigotry known around the world in a way that, say, Kurdophobia or anti-Zoroastrianism simply are not. Similarly, anti-Zionism is a bigotry known around the world in a way that perhaps Japanophobia or anti-Argentinianism simply are not. Hating the Jews, hating the Jewish people and the Jewish nation is an international malady that can only be explained by understanding the hatred to the notion of a creator God and his eternal existence that underlines the existence of Israel on the world stage today and has continued for 4,000 years in opposition, the world in opposition to the divine revelation of Israel. They hate Israel because they hate the miracle. Christians in Western civilization, sympathetic secularists alike, who might have a fleeting inclination to ditch the broader notion and the broader nation of Israel and the specific state of Israel in the rearview mirror, would be wise to remember that the stakes of our civilizational clash are considerably higher than the mere future of the Jews. There are real people out there who really do seek nothing less than the destruction of Western civilization itself. Here's the summary. No more Israel, no more Western civilization as we know it. Why do people who live in the Western society think it is cool to be anti-Semitic? It's a delusion. There's no other sensible, common sense reason for it. A disastrous mass hysteria. Would the Creator, the God of the Bible, keep this particular people alive and in existence for over 4,000 years to let it be destroyed in these political times? Self-identified conservatives and those in the... We have to put politics aside now to look at the principle here. Must also be students of history, again, of the Bible too. And accordingly, they should be aware of all the various nations and empires throughout human history, from the Babylonians to the Romans to the Nazis, to the modern Islamists, with so many others in between who died off and met history's ash heap after attacking, assaulting, and pillaging the Jews. However, a dire warning to any nation or people who dares to mistreat God's people, remember, he who curses Israel will be cursed. Finally, Israel, he says, may well be the most legitimate state on earth, and therefore the pillar on which the legitimacy of the global order of nation states rests. The notion of a defined physical territory for the ancient Israelites from the river until the great river, the river Euphrates, is something that goes back as far as God's promise to the patriarch Abraham itself. There is no extant nation state on earth that has as deep historical ties to the physical land in which that nation rests, but the nation state roots of Israel compromise many other layers beyond Scripture. The ultimate purpose to the world was fulfilled through the Son of God, Jesus Christ. And this is the saving power for the nations, the power that the nations have done everything imaginable to resist. From the beginning of time, from the beginning of the existence of the family of Abraham. This, as a summary, is the linking between the Jewish faith and the covenant and the promises to Abraham and the Christian West. However, in the meantime, Israel is again fighting for its survival, not just as a people, but as an authentic nation state, despised by the world, rejected as a light-bearing nation, once again under siege but how will this go? So there's great comfort, isn't there, in the words of Isaiah the prophet. Is it too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel? I will make you as a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. Thus saith the Lord, the Redeemer of Israel and his Holy One, to one deeply despised, abhorred by the nation, the servant of rulers, kings shall see and arise, princes shall prostrate themselves before you. Isaiah 42, I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes of the blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. This brings us to our reading tonight. I've got to get there because I told Mark I'd get you out of here before midnight. Our reading tonight, a transition, friends, is already underway to resolve this problem. The restoration of the land of promise is already underway. The ancient prophet foresees a massive destruction of the territory of Gaza. He calls out Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron. There are five cities of the Philistines originally in the territory of Gaza, but they were all called the Cherethites, seacoast people, Philistines that occupied those cities. We now refer to that same area as Gaza. The word of the Lord is against you, O Canaan, land of the Philistines, and I will destroy you until no inhabitant is left. Woo! And you, O seacoast, shall be pastures with meadows for shepherds and folds for flocks. The seacoast shall become the possession of the remnant of the house of Judah, on which they shall graze, and the houses of Ashkelon, they shall lie down at evening, for the Lord their God will be mindful of them and restore their fortunes. Doesn't sound like a big city there, or a whatever Donald Trump has in mind. Sounds like a very peaceful land of pastures by the sea. A transition is happening. And what does the ancient prophet foresee? A massive destruction. And how does Zephaniah conclude this devastating prophecy? Sing aloud, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, rejoice and exult with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away the judgments against you. He has cleared away your enemies. Now we see this type of language in the Old Testament. When Joshua went into the land with the Israelites, they were supposed to clear away their enemies. And us folks who haven't been reading our Bibles might say, ooh, doesn't sound right at all. The King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. You shall never again fear evil. On that day it shall be said in Jerusalem, fear not, O Zion, let not your hands grow weak. The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you by his love. He will exult over you with a loud singing. I will gather those of you who mourn for the festival so that you will no longer suffer reproach. Behold, at that time I will deal with all your oppressors. At that time I will deal with all your oppressors, and I will save the lame and gather the outcasts, and I will change their shame into praise and renown in all the earth. At that time I will bring you in at the time when I gather you together, and I will make you renowned and praised among all the peoples of the earth when I restore your fortunes, says the Lord. This event, I believe, is well underway. The future glory of Israel. Arise and shine, for your light has come. The glory of the Lord has risen upon you. This is a picture of the final restoration, or the restoration of the nation of Israel and her enemies living in fear of her and running from her as the Lord clears the land. It's a massive word of encouragement for the Jews today, against all the oppression of the world around. Deuteronomy says this, be strong and courageous. Do not fear or be in dread of them. For it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you or forsake you. The same language again that was used with Joshua going in to the land to clean out the inhabitants. We are on the eve of a massive expansion of God's people. The golden age of Israel is coming upon us, and their enemies are literally scattering before them. And of Israel's might, military might, which is supported, of course, by the sovereign God of Israel that will soon set up a kingdom at the very center of God's governance in the land of Abraham, as clearly defined and preserved to this day. Same land, same places, Syria, Egypt, and Abraham in the midst of the land. We are spectators of this great change, this great fear that's and awe that's falling on the nations. And oh, Abraham, maybe we started out with Abraham, didn't we? Well, the Abraham Accords are a series of treaties normalizing diplomatic relations between Israel, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, Morocco, facilitated by the U.S. administration between August and December 2020. In the span of 5 short months, these 4 Arab states joined Israel and Jordan in making peace with Israel. And agreements were called, the agreements were called, the Abraham Accords, in honor of Abraham, the patriarch of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Now, many of the Arab nations claim descendancy from Abraham through Ishmael. So this is an interesting state of affairs. But what about Syria? Now, I might cheekily ask about that. Didn't we say that Abraham started in Syria, in Haran, went down to Egypt, and came back and established in the center of the land? Well, we had the answer to that this week. Trump says Syria asked Syria to join Abraham Accords, normalize ties with Israel in return for sanctions relief. So now we've got Egypt, Syria, if this works out, and a highway from Syria to Egypt with Israel, God's people at the center of the land. The highway is the ancient, well-trodden route of the patriarchs, mirroring the ancient travels of Abraham and Jacob from Syria to Egypt. Israel is returning to be a blessing in the middle of the land, and we are blessed to be observing this miracle today. And I have to ask you in your own time to read Isaiah chapter 19. Isaiah seems to have this picture sorted out. In that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and Assyria will come into Egypt, and Egypt into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. In that day Israel will be a third with Egypt and Assyria, and a blessing in the midst of the earth. Whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance, in the middle of the land. And I want to thank you for taking time to listen to me tonight. Got a ways to go till midnight, Mark. But I'm not sure there's any better way that I can conclude my thoughts tonight by the words of Jesus himself. Mark.